Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westaver.
I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about director, actor, and quirkmeister John Waters, who is a Baltimore guy. And I'm sure you've got better background info than I do, but I just wanted to mention a couple of things that I found out about him as a child, that as a youth, he would watch adult-only films at the local drive-in with binoculars. You know, he's obsessed with true crime and used to attend gory trials all over the U.S. where he often saw the same faces in the public galleries until he became so recognizable that he couldn't do that anymore. He grew up obsessed with violence and gore and has managed to parlay all of that early oddity into a career. Mike, where do we start with John Waters?
One of the most shocking things about John Waters is that he's now 75 years old and he refers to himself as a filth elder. Now, going back to his youth, he grew up in Lutherville, which is in Baltimore County, just above the Beltway, just above Towson. And you're referencing the Timonium Drive-In Theater. He would go to a hillside with binoculars and watch the movies for free. Or his friends, they would pile into the car, get this. And actually, this gets referenced in one of his later films, Cecil B. DeMented, which is about an independent filmmaker. But what they would do is, John would be at the wheel, let's say, driving the family car, and he'd be the only, ostensibly the only passenger. Because you know, at a drive-in back then, they might charge a carload by how many people in the car and do the math on it, what they're going to charge you. What they would do, it was so brazen, he said. He said he would be by himself at the wheel driving into the theater, the drive-in theater, and his two or three friends would be in the back seat under a blanket, like he was going to hide them. And he thought, we're going to get away with this? You know, he said, like who in the right mind would drive alone to a drive-in movie theater, right? In the meantime, there's something moving under that blanket in the back. But one time at the drive-in, it was either there or the Benjis, they were arrested for drinking. So they would go a few nights a week. Now at the drive-in, they would see a lot of exploitation movies. Herschel Gordon Lewis, you know, things like Blood Feast and 2000 Maniacs and films like that. A lot of B-movies and mainstream stuff as well. And so then, you know, he starts making his own short films in the early 60s, influenced by the exploitation movies, influenced by the American avant-garde, which merges with exploitation sometimes. And we can talk some more about those influences, if you will. For me, I love talking about John and have many times. On a professional level, I can tell you that the first time I ever saw him, I was still a high school student. I was living near the UMBC campus, but had no affiliation with the school. I was a high school kid, right? But I noticed that John Waters was coming to campus. And speaking of the early days of his film exhibition and distribution, such as it was his second film, Female Trouble, from 1974. John had the film in the trunk of his car, and he drove to Lecture Hall 2 at UMBC, and he presented it. And I fell in love. I thought, this is what I want to watch. This is what I want to be. This is my everything. My head spun around. And I didn't talk. I was too timid, I think, to talk with him on that occasion. That was the first time I saw him as a high school kid. That's on a professional level. I first met John when I was 18 and working as a film critic already at that point. And in the decades since then, I've interviewed John many times. And so we go, as John once said to somebody, he said, Mike and I go way back, and so there's a lot to say there. But on a professional level, I mean, with some air of detachment, I can say that, you know, I've written about him so often and interviewed him so many times, sometimes standalone interviews, sometimes I'm doing another story and want to grab a quote from John. Anyway, many interviews. On a personal level, and this is why I love to talk about him, but I have to be a little careful too, because on a personal level, we have so many mutual friends that over the decades, so many times we're at the same party or same event or hanging out at the same bar, you name it. And so there's a lot I'm happy to talk about, you know, and believe me, I'll go on for hours with it. But, you know, in terms of a more personal friendship there, I think we all sort of draw the line in terms of, because people ask me, what's he like and this and that. And I think, well, I've got to do some editing as to what I'll share and what I won't share. Not that there's anything scandalous per se, but just simply that, you know, the way we respect our friends' privacy in some ways. But anyway, I'll go on for hours unless you stop me. So let me turn it back over to you at this point, and you can guide me. You can tell me, Mike, talk about this or talk about that. And I'll go off like a well-trained kid. I'll go off in that direction. So send me in what direction you will.
All right, I'm struck by the fact that as a youth, he made as much as $50 a week doing puppet shows for neighborhood children and was often hired to entertain at birthday parties. I don't find this to be at all surprising. I think some of his movies could read as sort of demented puppet shows for neighborhood children and birthday parties.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. He's just doing puppet shows on a somewhat larger scale and a relatively larger budget. But he's still essentially, you know, he writes and directs all of his own films. And particularly if they're really early films, you do a bit of everything, right? So he's the showman there. He's the ringmaster, if you will. The way a lot of kids would do, like, you know, back then he grew up in the, you know, 50s and early 60s, the rumpus room, they might've called it. And I know where that family, I've driven by his family's house many times. And so, I mean, I know the neighborhood, so he initially put on puppet shows there and then for the neighbors and so on, and he could make some money from it. Already he's thinking commercially, I can charge people to see my puppet shows. And the puppet shows were demented oftentimes, and some of his favorite, like Wicked Witch type characters and so on, I mean, they're popping up already. And then you watch the later movies, particularly the early things like Mondo Trasho and Multiple Maniacs, the set design still is like a big puppet show sometimes. Marie, you're absolutely right about that. And then when he makes his first short films, and these are really short, extremely low budget, like Hag in a Black Leather Jacket and Eat Your Makeup and Diane Linkletter Story, films he doesn't show now, partly because they're technically rather crude, beyond the crudeness that was intended. Also, there's some problems in terms of like music rights, because they would just grab music without any sense of, you know, paying royalties or anything. So there are various issues why the early films he's kept under wraps. But having seen clips from them and stills and occasionally a short film, a sense of them, the point that I'm making that doubles back on the puppet shows, just as you'd put on a puppet show at your parents' house, you know, he would film the earliest movies like in the yard. I mean, I recognize the yards, actually. I know that part of Lutherville. I recognize where those scenes were being shot. And he really, you know, his parents were extremely conservative. And so they were quite shocked by some of the movies he was doing. And I actually met his parents once, and here's how. In 1985, when John had become respectable in the early 1980s, Baltimore City declared John Waters Day in Baltimore. And as part of that, the Baltimore Museum of Art had a ceremony honoring John. And I had written a newspaper article about it in advance, you know, a feature article. And in that article, I described John as the loving son to sorely tried parents. And in his onstage remarks that night, John actually, he thanked me for the article on stage. And then afterwards at the reception, he walked over to me and he said, Mike, come over here. My parents want to meet you. He said, my mother said she wants to meet the man who wrote that sentence, loving son to sorely tried parents. So I met both of his parents there. And the other thing I'll share in terms of how the parents responded, his mother eventually became a good sport about it. And the father, maybe not quite as much, but to his credit, what his father did was when John was making his earliest films, you know, for $1.98, right? He still maybe didn't have the $1.98, but the earliest films, John's father actually lent him the money to make some of the early movies on the condition that he'd be paid back. And John was always enormously proud of the fact that he not only paid his father back for those loans, but with interest. The other condition that the father set was, I'll give you the money for these films, you know, the very early ones, provided I don't have to watch them. And so his parents never saw the really early filthy stuff like, you know, Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble. Later on, it's different. And we'll get to that point where the career takes a turn, if you will, and it's safer for parents, if you will, to watch some of, and safer for children to watch some of the later stuff. But Marie, you're absolutely right. Essentially, these are elaborations on a puppet show. So I'm talking again already in a long-winded way, but doubling back on your point that there's that make-believe, let's put on a show. And it's very much a countercultural show, but it's a show.
Yeah, the Let's Put On a Show with Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, except it's not that show. It's the dark underworld kind of show. That's actually his genius, though. I want to mention about Pink Flamingos, that he talks about how that is the movie that put him on the map. That's what everybody talks about. That's how his parents found out about the movie, because he was an answer on Jeopardy. And he said that that's when he knew he had arrived. When you are one of the cheap early answers on Jeopardy, that means your career is going well. Now, he is like the king of the well said thing and of, you know, well said sarcasm. But what I want to mention, because I know you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about, you know, he likes to talk about, you have to know the rules of good taste before you can actually play with bad taste. And he says you should strive to make art in reverse. What I'm getting at here is there's a real intellectual side to John Waters that I think he is sort of parodying when he does these movies, because apparently he goes to every first run movie, hardly ever rents movies. I don't know, 8,000 books in his house. He subscribes to what, 80 magazines or something. He's very well read. He's very, very smart, very intellectual. And his movies are the exact opposite. How do you reconcile those two different things, Mike?
There are so many things one could say at this point. To his character, he's extremely smart, extremely literate. He's a journalist's dream because he's a quote machine. Everything he says is quotable. It's just incredibly sharp, really witty. And in fact, we can mention this later as well, but in addition to his films, read his books. He's published 6 books, starting with Shock Value in 1981. Those essays are terrific. He really has his finger on the pulse culturally there. In terms of cinematic taste, I'd see him at the movies all the time, and he would tell me funny stories. We would trade stories about films we'd seen. One time we were talking about some high art film, like a really snooty high art film, and we agreed that we really loved it, right? And then John laughed and he said, "Mike, don't tell anybody that I like that movie. It'll ruin my reputation." You know. And so he would make distinctions. And Marie, this is to your question, distinctions between like just bad taste and what he would call good bad taste. But he would go to see everything just to see it, to know it. Like one time he told me I was writing about films, you know, every week, reviewing films, and whether I wanted to go or not, I was going. It was my excuse professionally. Like somebody said, "Why did you go to see that movie? You got in the car and drove to that mall theater. Why?" Well, I had to. I had to review it. So always my professional excuse. I had to see it. I would have gone anyway, but I had to see it. So John, actually, he and I were talking once, and I just seen My Little Pony. Think about that years ago, that animated thing. And he went to see it too, at one of the suburban mall theaters. And he said it was a matinee, and he was the only man in the theater. It was otherwise all young mothers with their small children. And he said the women looked over at him, and they clutched their children closer. But he would go to see those things. So one other time, we were talking about essentially questions of taste. That's what you're getting at with your question, really. And he made this distinction. He said, "Mike," he said, "you know," he said, I like great art, and I like great trash, and I like very little in between." And it's really sort of the middle brow film that, you know, he'll watch stuff like that, but that, so what, you know? I mean, he was so funny once. He was trashing a film we talked about in a recent episode for Tom Hanks, Forrest Gump, which he hated absolutely. It was just like, for him, the epitome of middle brow taste. He just hated some. He said, "Oh, when Forrest Gump was running across the field, he thought I was going to retch. I had to get out of the theater," kind of thing, you know? But talk about a really great art film, you know, talk about Bergman or Tarkovsky or something. And he loves those great art films, and talk about real trash. And he knows that stuff inside and out. And it's always being referenced in his films. So in his films, he tries to actually make films that are trashy, but in a knowing, deliberate way. His films are all scripted. And people sometimes don't believe that. I mean, the really early films were not. It was guerrilla filmmaking, you know, and they would go out into the field and just shoot anywhere and just make stuff up. But once you get into the real feature film career, I've read the published screenplays. I mean, it's all scripted. And so what seems like just improvisatory ranting is actually scripted on the page, and you have to memorize it. One of my favorite stories is, I mean, the actor best known for work, of course, is Divine, and we can talk about that, Debbie, in a bit, but also other actors like Edith Massey, who was in the early films. I mean, I used to, she had a shop in Fells Point called Edith's Shopping Bag, and I would stop in just to talk to her. She was such an unreconstructed Baltimore character, the Baltimore Hun accent, and just really a sweet lady. Not the brightest bulb by all, and she couldn't memorize dialogue. She always would forget her dialogue. And John, she played the egg lady in Pink Flamingos. She's sitting in a playpen talking about eggs, and you have to see it to believe it, right, or not believe it. But she couldn't remember her lines. And one of the things that drove John insane, because he was like a really tightly controlled director. Here's the script, here's the lines. Edie tried, but she couldn't remember her lines. And so here's one thing she would do. You know, when you're reading a screenplay, or if you're reading a play, period, you have your scripted dialogue, of course, you also have your stage directions. So imagine you're an actor prepping for the scene, and you look at the script, and your line of dialogue is, "No, I ain't going over there." And then right under that is your stage direction, "She walks to the left." Edie would read everything out loud. She'd be doing her dialogue, and this is the one when they're shooting, she'd say, "No, I ain't going over there." She turns to her left. You know, she would actually say all that. And John would say, "Edie, no, that's your stage direction. You don't read that out. You don't say that out loud and doing it." And she would apologize, but then on the next take, she'd do it again or something else. So, you know, very much wanting to get the right tone with his exact words. I mean, he's actually quite exacting in terms of what he wants on screen. But Maria, let me turn it back to you, and we can double back on this because it's essential to talk about his sense, his aesthetics, if you will, his sense of taste and of what he would call good, bad taste.
Well, to prepare for the show, I watched Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble again. And I don't know if I'm going to be the same afterwards, because there was just some really, really, I can't even describe. It's really hard to describe. You just really have to see. But I do have a quote from him about pink flamingos that I think is really on point. And I want to see what you think of this. He says, you know, he doesn't think it's his best movie, but it's going to be the first paragraph of his obituary. Anyway, he says, it helped make trash more respectable. It lasted longer than I would have imagined. I still meet young kids who've just seen it and react with the same disbelief that people did the first time. I'm proud of it. It was made to make fun of censorship laws at the time. All that is kind of faded. If I hadn't done the scene where Divine ate dog crap, Johnny Knoxville would have done it in Jackass. The Jackass movies are the closest in spirit to pink flamingos and anything else. Yes, I would say the Jackass movies have that outrage, but I don't think it has any sort of art to it, where I think you could argue that pink flamingos is more artistic and so is Female Trouble. As weird and bizarre as they are, Jackass, they aren't.
Well, speaking of Jackass, Johnny Knoxville would work with John later on. He would appear in one of John's later movies. So it all comes home to roost at that point. In terms of Pink Flamingos, bear in mind it was made for $10,000. You know, it's a 90-minute film, $10,000. And knowing a lot of the people who worked on it, they were Dreamland Productions. It was his core team of actors and crew who stayed with him all through the years. The story, to the extent that I can tell it in a PG-rated version, you know, involves two families competing for the title of, you know, the filthiest person alive, you know, and of course, Divine, you know, is determined to claim and hold that title. In terms of, you know, that infamous ending, I know where it was shot in Mount Vernon, the corner, there should be a plaque there, right? This is the corner where Divine did the deed. And I know the dog's owner, actually. And so the thing is, it was really done. And John said, he said, he's been asked this a million times. He said, yes, Divine really did eat that. And the way it's shot, there are no cuts. I mean, the camera holds. The poor dog wouldn't cooperate for the longest time. They chased the dog around, and the dog belonged to one of the crew members. But the dog, you know, they tried feeding it and this and that, not to get too gross with the details, but they tried to get the dog to do its thing. And dogs, you know, when nature calls, it calls, right? So they spent a long time walking around the neighborhood with the dog. Then when the dog's finally ready for its moment, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up. At that moment, you know, they had something turned on the camera, and Divine did the deed. And John has said in many interviews, Marie, exactly what you quoted. He knows that whatever else he does in life, that is going to be in the first paragraph of his obituary. And John is such a news hound. You're right. He subscribes to dozens of magazines and newspapers. He reads omnivorously. He has a great personal library, a great, great personal library. And he knows that'll be the lead there. His favorite film of his, and it's also mine, and a lot of other people said this too, Pink Flamingos is from 1972. His greatest film, without a doubt, is Female Trouble from 1974. It has a tremendous thesis, crime is beauty. I mean, that's like the defining thesis for him there. And you have, you know, Divine and Eve Massey, and you got all the core company. And it just, it's really terrific. It's just every theme, every obsession he's had is in that film. And not only is it like really well done, and I have to make quotation, air quotes around that in terms of what it means to be well done, but you know, it's so effective for what it is. And on a purely provincial note, on a personal note, it was the first one I saw of his. So sure, that's a nostalgic part of it for me personally, but strike that, it's more a matter of within the film itself for anyone who grew up in our area. And on a very provincial note, Howard County figures into it. Towards the end of it, you know, Divine's on the run from the law and, you know, a criminal escapade and so on. And there's a nightclub scene with Divine jumping up and down on a trampoline. That scene was shot in a little theater on the corner on Main Street in Ellicott City, because that has oftentimes been a theater and a club, right? That was shot there. And when Divine, trying to run away from the police, goes swimming across the river, that's the Patapsco River in Ellicott City. So we have provincial pride in this film too, the extent to which it's not just Baltimore, but you know, Howard County figures into it as well. But John has said many times, he really thinks Female Trouble is his best film. And I would agree with that. And if you read other critics and just, you know, biographers and some people writing about John, it's often cited as certainly many people's favorite, or at least on the short list for people of favorite films. But Marie, you're right, back to your original point, Pink Flamingos was so notorious on the midnight movie circuit. I mean, that's the thing back then, you know, it would play around the country, but if you wanted to see it, it was like Friday and Saturday night at midnight. And if you liked it, you'd go back the following weekend and take your friends. Talk about a cult following, right? And so people would like memorize the dialogue. There are people who just know it so well They can give you all the scatological dialogue, if you will. I don't know if that's an accomplishment to boast about, but, you know, I had that kind of, that was the period when you had, like, you know, Rocky Horror Picture Show and things like that, you know, playing at midnight. And Pink Flamingos was on the short list, and it really made John's reputation. And big people in New York, Andy Warhol, people like that, were already knew John, but that was where, like, he was sort of brought into the fold of, like, leading avant-garde filmmakers.
You know, he has said if he had to make Pink Flamingos 2, you know, what would I do? He said, I guess I would have to have, you know, the dog eat human crap.
Well, Marie, I can answer that question. He tried to make a sequel called Flamingos Forever. And I just read the script the other night. It's been published. He wanted to do a sequel to Pink Flamingos, Flamingos Forever. And let me try to put this discreetly in terms of what you were getting at. Think about how Pink Flamingos ends, what Divine eats, right? You know, we got to be careful here in terms of, you know, we're on the air, but what Divine eats. Well, at the end of Flamingos Forever, which was never produced, they go flying off on a giant fill in the blank, which is sort of like, he wanted to be like the flying carpet, he said, in Thief of Baghdad, that they go riding off into the horizon. But what they're riding on is the very thing that was eaten at the end of the first film. Now, why wasn't it made? And this gets into a longer discussion about why he's had trouble raising money for various film projects. Flamingos Forever, he couldn't get the financing like out of the gate when he wanted it. Then, sad to say, Divine and Edith Massey and other people had died. So what are you going to do? And eventually he realized it would be a sequel never made. He had once said he'd never make a sequel. And then he said, well, I'm a hypocrite. I want to make this sequel. But in any event, it was never made. But there's a book that's called like Filth Trio. And it's Pink Flamingos, Flamingos Forever, and also the script for Desperate Living from 1977. And you can read all those screenplays there. And they're hilarious to read too, because you just, if you've seen the films, you can hear the dialogue in your head, you know, as they deliver this. But that's that phase through the 70s when he's doing the scatological films. And that's like the first half of the career, if you will. So Marie, let me turn it over to you at this point, because he is going to have a bit of a career transition in the years right after that.
Still stuck on the fact that he calls himself Filth Elder, because I think that's hilarious. He's also known as the Pope of Trash and the Prince of Puke. And he has said that, you know, if somebody threw up in one of his movies, it would be like a standing ovation. I mean, he is so funny in the way he refers to himself, you know, about how his movies are meant to be, you know, crimes against comedy, that kind of thing. But we are, you know, I'm mindful of the time we have left. I want to ask you to respond to this idea, because you mentioned the Rocky Horror Picture Show and Andy Warhol, which I had written down. But doesn't his career kind of dovetail with the explosion of porn in terms of movie making, Deep Throat in terms of Watergate, and R. Crumb? How does John Waters fit into like the panoply of perversion?
Well, this is one reason why his career takes a turn. He realized once you've done Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble, how do you top yourself? And he didn't want to get to the point where he's always trying to like outgross himself. You know what I mean? Like not box office grosses, but gross out stuff, vomit inducing stuff. He just thought, you know, should you keep going down that path? And he thought, no, you know, so two things percolate here. Two things are relevant. One is he didn't want to get trapped that way, like always having to top himself with something incredibly gross, right? The second thing was that mainstream culture, including the Jackass movies you referred to before, had co-opted, you know, things that were so filthy when he was doing them as an underground filmmaker in the 70s were being incorporated increasingly in mainstream Hollywood films. Think about horror films like, you know, Saw and things like that. These are released by major studios. Think about, you know, horror films, Friday the 13th type films and so on. Think about raunchy comedies, you know, Porky's and things like that, Jackass. Hollywood is making films like what he used to do. So in terms of the R-rated and X-rated stuff that he was doing, by the time you get to Polyester in 1981 and the career from then to the present, he's deliberately recalibrating. He's making films that are just very campy, still very, very, very kind of like filthy minded, but in a kind of clever, whimsical way. And he sometimes deliberately wants to get a PG rating, you know, which is shocking in its own way. But, you know, you think about Polyester from 1981, you think about Hairspray from 1988, Crybaby, 1990, Serial Mom, 1994, Pecker, 1998. Think about films like that, which really, they can still kind of like push the envelope in terms of subject matter. But, you know, I'm getting at, but there's a, I hate to use the word gentler, but relatively speaking, there's a more humane or gentler kind of whimsical quality to them. So the career, in terms of the filmography, there's a real shift that takes place. There's a real change from, you know, as you get into the 1980s and from there into the 1990s, it's still recognizably John Waters, but in a different key, if you will.
Now, I have some great quotes from John Waters I want to throw in here. You may have some you want to throw in here at our last couple of minutes. He says, "I pride myself on the fact that my work has no socially redeeming value." Who else but John Waters would even say such a thing? And then in terms of some of his favorite films, no film can come near the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and its snuff-like power to horrify. Just saying that great title out loud should give even real serial killers the creeps. And of course, he's a big fan of The Wizard of Oz. Now, you know, he has said that, you know, he sobbed at the end of The Wizard of Oz because, you know, Dorothy was in this fabulous place with color and flying monkeys and lions that talked. And then she comes back to dreary Kansas. And, you know, he was the first person to say what I had always thought about that movie. So I think that's why I will always appreciate him. But again, about The Wizard of Oz, she says, "When they throw the water on the witch," she says, "who would have thought a good little girl like you could destroy my beautiful wickedness?" All right. Now, John Waters says, "That line inspired my life. I sometimes say it to myself before I go to sleep like a prayer." I mean, he is just the most hilarious person. All right, my last quote from him is, he says, "A movie star is someone you want to either get drunk with or have sex with." And so despite the fact that his movies may be really sleazy, he must still be a movie star because I wouldn't mind getting drunk with him. Mike, have you ever gotten drunk with John Waters?
Yes, I have, but that would be another half hour story. He has a framed photograph of Margaret Hamilton, the Wicked Witch of the West, which is a treasure for him. But in terms of his cleverness, which you cite in those quotes, watch his live show. He does stand-up comedy. He's really good. He makes a lot of money, actually, making personal appearances because he's so quick on his feet that way. Secondly, read his books. He has not made a feature film in quite a while, but boy, he's prolific as an author. Shock Value in 1981 was the first. After that, Crackpot, Role Models, Car Sick, Make Trouble, and Mr. Know-It-All, which was published a couple of years ago. These are really terrific books, and you get all the wit, all the cleverness in those books.
I've read some of his books, and you're absolutely right. They're just as good as his movies and his quotes in terms of readability and funny things to say. But that does bring us to the end of our show. Don't forget to check out our other episodes at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.